From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Jeff Sechel is my guest. His latest book is Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt and the Supreme Court. Jeff Sechel has also written Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud that Defined a Decade. He also wrote speeches for President Bill Clinton, and he was the creator of Thatch, the syndicated comic strip starring PC Person. Jeff Sechel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your new book, Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt and the Supreme Court, it's not ancient history, but it goes just beyond the reach of living memory. So how did you do it? Did your own time in the White House help you create the vivid picture of Roosevelt's time?
I think it did. You know, I've written, as you mentioned, two books now about presidents, about presidential history, and I wrote one before I went to work in the White House and one after. And it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly how the experience of working in the White House affected my writing or my perspective, but I felt that I could write, even though I was writing about a time well before I was born, I felt that I had a better sense of the environment and the sorts of decisions that presidents make and the sorts of pressures that presidents experience and so forth. So I think it certainly informed my writing, but beyond that, it'd be very hard for me to say exactly how.
Well, I don't know the type of research that you do in your writing, but when you were researching Lyndon Johnson and Robert Kennedy, there were a lot of people alive who remembered it and could talk to you about it, whereas I think that's probably not the case now with FDR in the court.
That's right. I really enjoyed, in the research process for Mutual Contempt, I really enjoyed the opportunity to get to sit down and talk with folks like Ted Sorensen and a lot of other participants who had worked for Robert Kennedy or for Lyndon Johnson. In this case, as you suggested, it really wasn't possible, except in a couple of cases. And I did actually get to sit down and talk at length with three gentlemen who were in their 90s, two of whom are still with us in their mid-90s. I just had lunch with one a couple of weeks ago, who were not only around at the time, but were there in the midst, who were working for or with some of the key protagonists in this story, whether in the White House or on the Supreme Court as clerks.
Well, I guess I can imagine then that working in the White House yourself, you could really relate, I guess, to that kind of activity and the urgency that comes along with working in the government.
That's right. I do think that one of the things that's striking when you're fortunate enough to get to work in the White House is to feel or to hear the echoes of history in what you're doing. And it's a building, the White House, as we all know, that's just filled with history, and you never stop being aware that this is the same East Room in which Thomas Jefferson stood, or that this is the same cabinet room in which President Kennedy and his ex-com considered what to do about the Cuban Missile Crisis and so forth. And so I think that not only do you feel the history when you're there, but I think after you leave, you start to read history a little bit differently, and as I suggested before, you start to write history a little differently as well.
Well, how did you, if you don't mind talking about it a little bit before we talk more about FDR, how did you get your job writing for President Clinton?
Well, I got the job by writing my last book, Mutual Contempt. I had written that book in the mid-90s, and it came out in late 97, and out of the blue one day, I got a nice cardboard envelope in the mail that said White House on it, and so I eagerly opened that up, and in it I found a handwritten note from President Clinton, who, as it turned out, had been reading my book, and told me so in this nice handwritten note, and said some nice things about the book, and I, of course, framed it and told my family and some friends about it, and never expected anything else to come of that. But a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from President Clinton's chief speechwriter, who said, "Look, as you know, the president read your book, and we're interested in seeing if you'd like to come over here and talk about a speechwriting job, because we happen to have an opening." And I was very interested, and went over, and before I knew it, I had the job, and I began work there in the beginning of 1998.
Had you ever written speeches before?
I'd written exactly one speech in my life as an intern on Capitol Hill. I was interning for my congresswoman, Pat Schroeder, who some people might remember.
Yes.
And I was asked, between opening the mail and answering the phones, I was asked at one point to write a short speech as a tribute to America's nurses. And so that was my one contribution before the day that I walked into the West Wing to start writing these speeches. So it was a... It was a trial by fire, certainly.
And you were there during the most turbulent period, personally, I would imagine, for President Clinton.
That was part of the fire, I guess, which we all experienced. That's right. I actually got my job offer formally. I began talking with the folks in the Clinton White House in late 1997, but my job offer, just purely coincidentally, actually came through the day that the Lewinsky scandal broke. And so I had a big decision to make as to whether to go in, because as everybody will remember, that was the week in which George Stephanopoulos and a lot of other people were on the air predicting that Clinton wouldn't last another 2 days or maybe at best 2 weeks. I decided to take a gamble, and I was always glad that I did. I got to be there for the last 3 years of the term, and although the scandal certainly colored some of that period, we felt very strongly, and I think really the American people felt, that we got a lot done during that period.
What exactly did you write for President Clinton?
Gosh, I wrote all kinds of things. I mean, we were all expected to be generalists, and so one day you might be writing a tribute to Senator Moynihan on giving him the presidential Medal of Freedom, and the next day you might be writing a 40-minute economic policy address, and then 2 days later you might be writing a eulogy to a civil rights leader who had died at the age of 90. And then the week after that you could write a big speech on global poverty and the new policy that the administration was rolling out. So that was one of the things that I loved about the job, was the endless variety and also the opportunity to get, over the course of 3 years, deeper and deeper into some of these issues and really develop some level of specialization.
We're talking with Jeff Sechel, and in addition to being a speechwriter for President Clinton, he's just written this fabulous new book, very well-reviewed book, called Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt versus the Supreme Court. It must have felt great when the New York Times reviewed your book.
It does feel pretty good, you know. Review space is shrinking in newspapers, so you don't take it for granted that you're going to get reviewed at all. And then when you get reviewed well, it's obviously even better. So, yes, that was very exciting.
Well, let's talk about the book a little bit. The situation for those people who don't know. I mean, I guess that's kind of an interesting part about writing a book like this. I guess the people who are most likely to read it already know how it turns out.
Well, that's right. There's no disguising the ending, that President Roosevelt didn't actually get to pack the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court stayed at the number 9. There are not 15 people on the Supreme Court today. So that is given away, but how we actually get... there are two parts of the story, really the entire story, when you add them together, that I think is filled with a lot of mystery, even for people who feel that they have some familiarity. How in the world, first of all, did he come up with this idea of trying to pack the Supreme Court? Where did this come from? How did he think that he could possibly get away with this? And then secondly, how did it all fall apart? Most people have a sense that President Roosevelt was enormously popular, which of course he was, and people do know that he was reelected in 1936 by one of the biggest landslides in American history. How is it that he was denied by the Senate the chance to do what he demanded to do at the beginning of his second term? And so that's the story that I very much wanted to tell. And also it's a story not only of what happens in the White House or in the Oval Office, but it's a story of what happens in the Supreme Court, and what prompts the Supreme Court in the middle of this fight to suddenly reverse itself, and after knocking down New Deal programs for years, to suddenly start approving them. And also what happens in the Congress, and how it is that this Congress, that was so often likened to a rubber stamp during Roosevelt's first term, suddenly, as I suggested before, defies him on court packing.
Yeah, just to define for the for our listeners, he wanted to add, President Roosevelt wanted to add six justices, a justice to assist every justice over the age of 70. Is that right?
That's right. Here's what he proposed to do. In February 1937, just right after he took the oath of office for the second time, he proposed to increase the size of the Supreme Court, as you just pointed out, from 9 to 15. And the pretext was that this was the oldest Supreme Court in American history, and that for every justice over 70 who refused to retire, the president would immediately get to appoint another justice, a younger justice, to essentially sit by the side of the older man and help him with his work. And Roosevelt suggested, untruthfully, that the court was behind in its work and needed this sort of help. But everybody understood that this was really an assault against the conservative ideology of the Supreme Court. The other thing I think most people don't know is that the number 9 doesn't exist anywhere in the Constitution. That the Constitution does tell us that justices will have life tenure, but it doesn't say anywhere how many Supreme Court justices there should be.
And had the court been altered before in the past?
The court had been altered many times, going back right to the very beginning of the Republic. In fact, when Thomas Jefferson was elected and the Federalists were about to go out of power, they immediately voted in the Congress to eliminate, the Supreme Court was set at 6 at that time. And so they voted to eliminate one of the seats, so that when Jefferson came, pending the next retirement, they couldn't kick somebody off the Supreme Court. But they said when somebody retires, that seat will no longer exist, just so that President Jefferson would not get the chance anytime soon to appoint somebody. This happened also to President Andrew Johnson later in the 19th century. The court went up and down in size over the course of the 19th century, usually for political reasons. It went as high as 10 under Lincoln and then came back down to 9 under Grant in 1869, and that's where it stayed. And so by 1937, the number 9 had this feeling of being preordained by the founders. It had this sense that it was set in stone, when in fact it wasn't, and that was one of the things that Roosevelt was up against.
Is it set in stone now?
It is not set in stone. In fact, Congress could vote tomorrow, and the president could sign a bill changing the size of the court to 17 if he wanted to. It's entirely up to Congress.
Now, I was interested in your book that money played a role in justices' decisions not to retire.
Well, this is one of the great ironies that I discovered in this whole struggle, is that here you have this Supreme Court, this very conservative Supreme Court that had been a powerfully conservative, some would say reactionary force in American life, going all the way back to the late 19th century, really, at least to the 1890s. This was a court that had overruled the income tax, so that the income tax had to be recreated by a constitutional amendment. This was a court that had overturned a federal ban on child labor, saying there was nothing in the Constitution that gave Congress the power to ban child labor, and so forth. And so there's this feeling that on the part of Roosevelt on the way into office in 1933, and the feeling on the part of most observers that a conflict is inevitable, and indeed the conflict does come in 1935 when the court starts striking down the New Deal. But this irony that you pointed out is that there were a couple of the conservative justices, two of them, who were old, as I mentioned, and had been ill, and really just wanted to get out of town. They really were ready to leave the court, and I found some correspondence between these justices and their families saying, even if Roosevelt wins, I want to quit the court. I'm ready to quit the court. But the reason that they didn't do it in the end is because Congress, during the Depression in 1932, decided to slash the pensions of Supreme Court justices, retiring Supreme Court justices, to cut them in half, from $20,000 to $10,000, which was a lot of money at the time, particularly during the Depression. And so the justice that was affected by this when he retired was Justice Holmes, the great Oliver Wendell Holmes. And this was such an indignity that there was an outcry, and Congress wound up restoring the pension. But the justices, in their correspondence makes this clear, felt very insecure. And they felt that if Congress did this once, Congress will do it again, and they didn't feel that they could retire with any feeling of security. So they stayed on the court as long as they possibly could, and then they found themselves in this pitched battle with Roosevelt, and they were certainly not going to retire in the midst of that.
It was a kind of an interesting tug of war, because the court becomes more conservative than it had been in the years leading up to this, yes?
Well, that's right. It becomes very aggressive, because, you know, keep in mind that these progressive laws that the court was striking down during the teens and during the 1920s, most of these progressive laws were state laws, because most of the experimentation in terms of social and economic policy was happening at the state level. These were the years of Harding, of Coolidge, of Hoover, and so there wasn't a lot of great liberal legislation coming out of the Congress, and so the battleground shifts to the federal government under Roosevelt, and certainly the states were continuing to innovate as well. And so the court finds itself with a much more powerful foe than a state legislature. It's up against this incredibly popular president in the middle of a depression. And they believe that, and one of the things that I found so compelling about the struggle, and one of the reasons that I wrote this book, is because both sides in the struggle felt that the stakes were nothing less than the survival of democracy. Roosevelt felt that if he couldn't get these reforms past the Supreme Court, if he couldn't do something to ensure minimum wages, if he couldn't do something to improve working conditions and create jobs, that there would be a total economic collapse that would make the Depression look like a cakewalk. And those are the ashes from which dictators rise, as everybody saw in Europe. Meanwhile, the conservatives on the Supreme Court and their allies around the country, their supporters around the country, felt that if Roosevelt were able to centralize power in Washington in the way they feared he was doing, that he would become a dictator and it would be the end of democracy in America. So both sides really felt that they were fighting for civilization.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about it in terms of contemporary history, that, you know, it now the government seems so impossible. It seems like it's impossible to govern, and that, you know, maybe a dictator is what's needed. But, of course, that's a scary thought.
Well, many people said that in 1933. It's remarkable, actually, how wide the range of commentators was who suggested when Roosevelt came into office that maybe he really just needed to act like a dictator. There was a very open question in 1933, at the beginning of 1933, which I guess has been reopened today to a lesser degree, whether democracy can really function in times of severe economic distress, whether the gears of the government can move quickly and effectively enough to really make a difference. And so even some of the folks on the right who became critics of Roosevelt's were urging him at the beginning of 1933 to nationalize the banks, which he refused to do, to nationalize the coal industry, and to essentially act like a dictator. Al Smith, who had run for president in 1928 and would become a fierce critic of Roosevelt's, starting to move to the right, even as a Democrat, Al Smith said, "What do? During wartime, we take the Constitution and we put it on a shelf. We put it aside for a while. And this is war, essentially. Depression is war, and maybe we need to do that right now." So Roosevelt really resisted those calls. He really felt that the Constitution was a flexible enough instrument that you didn't have to violate it to get stuff done. And so he really felt throughout that he was acting within the parameters that had been set by the framers of the Constitution.
We're talking with Jeff Sechel, and his book is called Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt and the Supreme Court. And he also wrote Mutual Contempt, Lyndon Johnson, Robert Kennedy, and the Feud That Defined a Decade. So let's compare and contrast a little. You've got Johnson, Roosevelt, Clinton, presidents you're well familiar with. So can you contrast them?
Well, I think one of the interesting comparisons really is between Roosevelt and Johnson, because, of course, Johnson, as many people know, felt that with the Great Society he was really completing and even possibly outdoing Roosevelt and the New Deal. And for a period of time in 1964-65, it really seemed that Johnson might do that with this incredible flurry of legislation from civil rights and voting rights, which neither of which had been a particular interest of Roosevelt's, to the war on poverty and other Great Society programs, Medicare, and so forth. But, you know, one of the areas in which the two of them were dramatically different as it became more apparent later in the 60s, is that Johnson really lacked an intuitive grasp of what the broader public believed or needed to hear from its leadership. He was wonderful in a room full of senators, and he could manipulate them, persuade them to no end, just like Roosevelt, maybe even more effectively than Roosevelt, because Johnson was one of them, had come from the Senate, unlike Roosevelt, who had come from New York, from the governor's mansion. But Roosevelt maintained, probably more than anybody we've ever seen in the presidency, this incredibly intuitive sense of where the public was. And Johnson didn't have that, and he had a sense of insecurity about it, that he understood his constituents, and he understood the Senate, his constituents in Texas, but when he began playing on the national stage, he was a little bit out of it.
Some of the frustration, I think, that people are feeling in politics today, which we definitely felt during the years of President Bill Clinton, and that people are beginning to feel now with Barack Obama, is their seeming inability to act and to make things happen in the way that both FDR and LBJ were able to do.
Well, I think that frustration is very real and it's very well-founded, and a lot of it has to do with the changes in the Congress. People point to the changes in the country, but and the mood of partisanship in the Capitol, but I'll tell you, we've got nothing on the 1930s. I mean, the attacks on President Obama as socialist are really nothing compared to the attacks on Roosevelt as a socialist or a communist or a fascist or any number of things, which frankly had a lot more bite. Nobody really in the country except members of the Tea Party really think that President Obama is a socialist or really know exactly what a socialist means. But there was a feeling in the 1930s as one country after another fell to dictatorship around the world, that communism, fascism, these were very real threats, and that Roosevelt, in the way that he was changing the very structure of government, might well be one of these guys. He might well be a communist or a fascist. So, you know, I don't think that partisanship is anything new in American history, but I think that where President Clinton struggled, where President Obama is struggling in ways that Johnson and Roosevelt didn't necessarily, has to do with the changes in the structure in Congress and the redistricting and the polarization of the membership in Congress, so that it's very hard to even create a moderate district anymore and so forth. And of course, the media environment, which is very different today. So I think that there are elements of our environment that conspire to make it very, very difficult to govern. And the power structure in Congress isn't anything like it was in the 1930s or the 1960s with these power barons who really wielded enormous power over their colleagues, had all sorts of rewards and punishments and so forth. As many commentators and political scientists have pointed out, members of Congress today are independent players in a way that they never could be before. And so it is just much harder to corral people and get things done.
Well, do you think that President Obama will encounter similar kinds of problems with the Supreme Court as he moves forward with his health care and other plans?
I think it's very much headed in that direction. I mean, one never knows. It's always hazardous to guess what justices are going to do, particularly when a given case is not even in front of them yet. But I think that this court, the New York Times just recently had an editorial summing up the term that just wrapped up in the Supreme Court, and it said the court's aggressive. It was titled the court's aggressive term, and certainly you saw in the Citizens United case on campaign finance and a number of other areas, you saw the conservatives on the court, and that includes the Chief Justice, getting more aggressive in their eagerness to overturn precedents that they don't like, in their eagerness to settle constitutional issues that are not necessarily required of them by the case at hand. And so I think that given the ideological bent of four and probably five members of the Supreme Court right now, it does seem to signal that there will be more trouble for President Obama, whether it's on financial reform, whether it's on health care, whether it's on any number of other important things that come before the court over the next few years. So, you know, unless one of the conservatives winds up leaving the court, then we're going to have the same balance of power on the court with Kagan that we've had for a number of years, and the dynamic is not likely to shift in any meaningful way.
You were there in 2000.
Yes.
In the White House. And that's when, I guess, the Supreme Court made their most aggressive ever, you know, at least in modern times, when they decided to give the presidency to Bush. What was the reaction like in the White House when that happened?
Well, the reaction was this kind of grim acceptance, knowing that there was absolutely nothing you could do. You could rail about it, and we did rail about it, and a lot of people right up the ladder railed about it. Even though people sort of suggested that this is what you would expect of the conservatives on this court, at the same time, I think there was a sense of shock that they would go so far as to effectively decide a presidential contest, and to decide it in the wrong direction, as we all saw it, that they would actually, for all the talk of federalism and of, you know, the rights of states and so forth, that they would actually shut down Florida's own process of recounting these votes. So there was some sense of shock at the extent to which these guys would go to settle the election the way they wanted it settled. But you knew there was not a thing you can do about it, and so you just had to start packing up and making your plans. It was a very grim period.
We're speaking with Jeff Sessional, and his book is called Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt and the Supreme Court. And it's a great book, and I thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf talking about it.
Well, many thanks. I appreciate it.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and join us again next week. My thanks to Jeff Sessional for being my guest. His book, Supreme Power, Franklin Roosevelt and the Supreme Court. I want to also thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Hey, be sure to check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.